Welcome to this members briefing for subscribers to the BizNews Club. I'm Alec Hogg. It's Thursday, the 13th of November, 2025, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence, the AI superpower countdown race for supremacy between the United States and China, drawing on our partners at the Financial Times of London. Well, it's hard to believe, but I first became exposed to the whole story of AI before COVID hit. It was back in 2019, and in Davos, I was invited by one of our then partners at the Wall Street Journal to go along to a talk by Dr. Kai-Fu Lee. Dr. Lee is Taiwanese. He is one of the most respected and influential commentators on artificial intelligence. And back then, he was famous for being, well, a senior executive, having worked for Google China, where he was president between 2005 and 2009. He had previously founded Microsoft Research Asia in 1998. So he is the co-chair of the World Economic Forum's AI Council, and he wrote an excellent book called AI Superpowers, which I've got a signed copy. So clearly I was there. I asked him. The lovely thing about at the World Economic Forum is they pretty much use it as a marketing place, and then they give away free copies of books. And this was one that I asked him to sign, the author to sign, and he duly did. Anyway, that's going back to 2019. The book, in fact, came out in 2018, the year before, and has been very widely acknowledged as one of the earliest landmark pieces of information on the whole AI future that, of course, now is on everybody's lips. But who's going to win? Should South Africa be backing the Chinese, or should it be, like most of the world, giving its attention to what's happening in the West, in Silicon Valley? Certainly, if you have a look at the way that we invest, then it certainly would appear as though Silicon Valley has got South Africa's vote right now. But perhaps there's more to it. So our partner at the Financial Times of London have one of their top podcasts is produced by Gideon Rachman. Gideon, who knows South Africa well, is from a South African family, is the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the FT. And once a week, he gets together and talks to experts in particular fields about subject matter that is close to his area of interest. In this one, this week, which in fact has just been published today, he has a look at who is going to win the AI supremacy fight and speaks to the FT's John Thornhill, his colleague who looks after innovation for the title, and to Saiwei Chen, who's with MIT Tech Review, MIT from Boston, Massachusetts. It's a fascinating conversation, and due to our partnership with the Financial Times, we can give it all to you here. So stand by, enjoy, and I'm sure, like me, you'll feel a lot more informed at the end of it.
This week's podcast is about the struggle for leadership in artificial intelligence between China and America. My guests are the FT's innovation editor, John Thornhill, and Saiwei Chen, China reporter for the MIT Technology Review. So, who's ahead in the race for AI supremacy?
No decision is without risk. And the risk we have to absorb here is going long on this, because it's not like we're not doing this in a vacuum. We are going to be the dominant player, or China's going to be the dominant player, and there will just be very different rules depending on who wins. And we cannot rely on anyone else to do this in our network of allies.
That was Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir Technology, speaking in a recent interview with Axios. Palantir is a software company that soared in value recently, partly because of its prowess in the use of AI and data for defense and intelligence work. Karp's view that America is now in a race with China for dominance of AI is one you'll hear often in both Silicon Valley and Washington. And there are some influential figures in the American tech scene who believe that America is already losing that race. Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, the leading semiconductor manufacturer, caused a stir recently when he suggested at an FT conference that China will win the AI race. So I began our discussion by asking John Thornhill about Huang's remark. What did he make of it?
Well, I think he subsequently modified his comments to say that US was still ahead in the race, but if it was not careful and it didn't accelerate, then China would overtake it. And I think that's probably right. For the moment, US, I think, has the lead in frontier models and is committing a colossal amount of investment to the infrastructure development. But China is adopting a very different approach. It's going for open weights models, which enable kind of mass applications of these models.
Sorry, John, just explain for a non-technical audience. Open weights, what's it mean?
So open weights are a different type of model from the closed weight models that are primarily used in the US. And it means that these large language models that are being developed are far more accessible for developers to download, to inspect and to modify. And that allows them, the developers, to have a lot greater flexibility in adapting these models for specific tasks. And it enables China, I think, to develop this technology and apply it far more quickly than you can using a kind of proprietary model developed by an OpenAI or Google, for example. You're seeing a lot of US developers actually adopting these Chinese models themselves because they are cheaper, faster, more agile, and are very powerful. So I think they're almost competing on different terrain, as it were. America is competing at the kind of commanding heights of this technology, and China is competing at the application layer.
Tsai Wei, what do you make of that?
I think John is so right. To answer the question of whether China is winning the AI race, we have to define what constitutes winning. And the two countries are really going on different definitions. I do think US today has a lead on the frontier cutting edge technology. And we're still seeing companies like OpenAI has this paradigm defining and agenda setting power in whatever it does with this new model. A lot of Chinese companies will follow suit. But these Chinese companies are catching up with what it can do at a faster and faster pace. Like John said, a lot of the models are open weight, which means they are available for developers around the world to download, to modify, to deploy, and much more affordable and also more efficient, as we can see with companies like DeepSeek. And this is very much related to NVIDIA with the computing resource shortage China is having. We're really seeing an emphasis on the smart and elegant engineering of these models, that they might do the same thing, but how do we get to do the same thing with fewer resources, fewer power? And also China is also deploying these technology a lot more faster. Government is giving a lot of support. And I really like to use Jeffrey Ding's words, who is a professor at George Washington University and one of the smartest person on AI and China issues, in my opinion. He used the word GPT, not as ChatGPT, but general purpose technology to describe AI, as in that AI is just like electricity in this way. It's not used for one specific purpose, but its power can only be unleashed when it's thoroughly and widely applied in the society. So in terms of that, I do think China has a great opportunity to lead on that.
And John, I think you think that the one possible edge that China might have is that it's already a manufacturing powerhouse and America does less manufacturing, as Donald Trump famously has complained, and that marrying China's manufacturing prowess with its AI prowess is potentially very powerful.
Yeah, I would. Been talking to a number of economic historians who have studied what happens when you adopt general purpose technologies like electricity or the railways or the first wave of kind of computers. And often you get the greatest economic benefit, not from the direct investment in those general purpose technologies themselves, but in what they call the complementary investments. So, for example, electricity came along, but it was only about 30 years later that people figured out the optimal way that you could build a factory and mass produce products using electricity. And so I think it's those in that complementary investment area, that's where China has a real edge because it has this extraordinary manufacturing base, very agile production. It has a process knowledge expertise as well. And so I think it's how you apply AI in that interface between the software and the hardware where China has a real advantage at the moment. And when it comes to embodied AI systems, whether in robots or cars or drones, I think China is forging ahead incredibly rapidly in those areas. And it's also adapting its infrastructure far faster than America to accommodate those new technologies. So I think, you know, autonomous cars, for example, you can accelerate their adoption by changing the infrastructure of cities. America is not really doing that, but I think there's a possibility of China is doing that. Is that right, Taiwei?
Yeah, for sure. Infrastructure-wise, China has a very different playbook compared to the US. And I saw FT just reported that Chinese government is providing subsidized cheap power for AI companies because training these AI models and running them takes a huge amount of power. And in the US, it doesn't work the same way, but China's top-down structure and special industrial policy has enabled the government to support private players, especially leading private companies on these endeavors to push for state-owned enterprises and the universities, the schools, and the small organizations to adopt these technology and really like diffuse it, use it. Even when it's not working, the government will bail them out.
So give me some concrete examples. I mean, as you say, they're diffusing it, they're using it. So what kind of things are happening in China that may not yet be happening in America in terms of the practical uses of AI?
I think one great example is in education. At MIT Technology Review, we did an article about how Chinese university and not just higher education organizations, but high schools and middle schools even are adopting AI, specifically DeepSeek-based systems, very rapidly under the national government, the Ministry of Education in China advocacy, or local governments like Beijing. They all have initiatives that ask universities to implement AI courses, not just for computer sciences, machine learning majors, but even if you're a humanities major, there are AI literacy courses. A lot of university students that I talk to using AI in their work is explicitly encouraged. And I think these sort of encouragement and optimism is often ignored. And well, like in the US or UK, we are seeing less optimism, but more caution when it comes to adopting these things. And besides schools, there are also hospitals, lawyers, especially like state affiliated and owned enterprises using AI and making their own system. I've seen a lot of developing effort on making a custom AI system for their business across like different sectors. And I think that is enabled by the cheap infrastructure and power offered by the government as well.
I guess, John, one of the places where America does still have an edge, which makes maybe Jensen Huang's comments particularly controversial, is semiconductor chips and particularly NVIDIA chips. And beginning under the Biden administration, they started restricting particularly NVIDIA selling its most advanced chips. But has that policy begun to boomerang on America? I mean, Huang certainly seems to think it has.
I think it has possibly in two senses. One is that, as Huang has argued, it deprives of a massive export market for its own goods. So it's depriving American companies of the opportunity to make a lot of money in China. And it's also acted as a fantastic stimulant to the Chinese semiconductor industry itself to develop technology faster than they otherwise would have done, and then to emerge as a real competitor to America. So for the moment, there's no doubt that America holds quite a significant lead, I think, in that semiconductor space. But the Chinese are investing massively in that area, accelerating very fast. And I think they will, over the years, emerge as a very formidable competitor in that area as well.
And the other thing that America's invested massively in is these data centers, incredibly energy-hungry data centers. But I've heard some discussion, which I must admit I don't fully understand, so if the two of you could explain to me, that China can somehow do this without having these massive data centers. Is that correct?
I think The answer to this question is very complicated. So for one, China has a really impressive and sort of frantic data center build out since last year. And in China, they actually invented a new word for AI centric data center called Zhisuan Zhongxin, which is smart computing center, to differentiate it from the previous CPU based data centers. And these data centers are hugely power hungry. And there was a time in China a year ago that individual builders can apply to build these facilities and get like a lot of incentives, subsidized land, subsidized power. And we actually did reporting on that, and it turned out quite chaotic. So a lot of these data centers are sitting empty. They're not like fully effectively used. And as it turns out, the big players like Alibaba, ByteDance, and DeepSeek are only using a very small portion of that. And the nature of the power consuming nature of AI training also means that a lot of small players are dropping out. So I do think China is going through a round of reshuffling. The government is bailing out like failed data centers and just another day of Chinese industrial policy. So I do think China is going by a different playbook.
And John, you know, we started with this quote about winning the AI race, but some people think it's very unhelpful to even think of it as a race, because it means that there'll be less cooperation between the US and China, the two world leaders on this topic. And yet the risks, according to some people, are existential.
I think there are two dimensions to that. I mean, one is that the race dynamics apply to the race between, say, OpenAI or Google or Anthropic to try to develop what they call artificial general intelligence, a kind of generalizable intelligence you can apply to any field and is superior to human intelligence, which would be, they think, a very significant breakthrough and would generate an enormous amount of kind of economic productivity and wealth and abundance. But there's also that geopolitical race between the US and China. And I think that obviously has a more of a military dimension. As we're seeing in Ukraine, we're seeing AI systems being applied to drone warfare on both sides. China, Taiwan, America are all investing very heavily in AI-enabled drone technology. And I think AI can also be applied in areas like cyber. And both sides are very worried about the power to magnify cyber attacks on each other and mess with each other's kind of nuclear control systems. So I think there is actually a strange kind of dynamic where both China and the US are looking to damp down some of the race dynamics in those really truly dangerous areas. And you do hear stories that there are kind of back channel negotiations between the two of them where they recognize that they have a mutual interest in slowing down the race dynamics in certain aspects of this.
Tsai Wei, how do you think those race dynamics are going to go? And do you have any belief that when it comes to the military applications of AI, they'll be able to cooperate at any level?
Unfortunately, I think military might be the one aspect in AI development that we're least likely to see any kinds of cooperation, probably, besides the commercial companies, like the big companies competing. And I think this US-China binary and race narrative, despite that we're coming to a moment of reflecting and slowing down in the media and in the public, it benefits a lot of people, NVIDIA included. But I do think this narrative is not as productive when both countries are trying to take a moment and think of the AI hype that has been running for a few years now and thinking, what areas do we actually need AI the most and what kind of development is not as helpful? And one aspect I also want to emphasize is I do think despite the company affiliation, we think, oh, Anthropic is an American company, DeepSeek is a Chinese company. But the researchers working at these companies are extremely transnational. A lot of the researchers at the US companies are of a Chinese origin. And among like everyone that I talk to when reporting on these, I do think people developing these systems and researchers are genuinely tired of this antagonism. We're also seeing more people doing the application layer. They're not building the models themselves, but they're using the models to build a therapy bot. They're using the model to build a tool helping lawyers. And these companies, like a lot of them run in the West, are also of a Chinese origin. And this this time around, I'm seeing entrepreneurs and founders that are global minded than ever. So I think eventually it will be really difficult to draw a clear line, and more difficult than ever to differentiate what is a Chinese company, what is an American company, and who is on which side. And I do think with the open source culture, there is a possibility in future for people to genuinely want this collaborative and everyone can contribute like culture.
Well, that's a kind of alluring picture. But when I think of what's happening in the United States now, there is this big crackdown on immigration, including on skilled immigration. And there is a paranoia about China. So when you speak to the Chinese researchers who are working at the big Silicon Valley companies, do they feel under pressure? I mean, are they worried about their visas? Are they getting offers to go back to China? Is that happening as well?
I actually did talk to many people about this recently. And interestingly, it remains largely unimpacted. I was speaking with an AI researcher a few days ago, and he was telling me, oh, like the new professors entering the job market this year, like he feels like 80% of them are of Chinese origin. And DeepSeek, they mostly use Chinese graduates of Chinese universities. So 10 years ago, there was a culture, if you graduated from Stanford, MIT, and you come back to China, you immediately get the best opportunities. People all want to work with you. But I think that has faded away. Chinese AI companies are increasingly operating under this belief that graduates of Chinese university, top universities like Tsinghua and Zhejiang University are as good. And they do the similar things with Stanford and MIT. And Chinese talent educated in the U.S. tend to remain in the U.S. and try to work at American companies. And they enjoy a lot of mobility. As the competition heat up, the top talent still mostly remain unimpacted under the visa restrictions. But I do think the message that these immigration policies are sending is counterproductive to newer students that seeks to enter this field. And it might widen the divide for like a lot of Chinese might not think about studying in the US at all if they're undergrad at this moment.
John, I mean, when I've spoken to some of the companies, I mean, obviously they have different lines, but you will definitely hear some of these American companies saying, don't regulate us too much, because if you regulate us too much, China will win. How much do you think that argument is A, being made, and B, working?
Well, certainly is one of the issues that Jensen Huang was talking about to the FT, that in America, from Washington anyway, there is very little now in the way of federal regulation on AI. There's no real impetus to enact that. But what you are seeing in the US is that a number of states are enacting state laws on AI, most notably California very recently. And so their real fear is that you're going to end up with a patchwork of AI regulations, which really will be quite cumbersome for them to comply with and slow things down. So perversely, it might actually lead to more impetus for a federal law. The Trump administration did push for a 10-year moratorium on all state laws on AI, but that did not get carried. So I think that's their concern about regulation. And in China, there are, in some areas, some very strict regulations on AI. So it's not true to say that there's no regulation in China. But I think the Chinese have got a clearer kind of regulatory framework in which to operate, and therefore the companies know where they can and cannot innovate at will.
Yeah. And how close is the cooperation? I mean, just on this geopolitical issue, I think you spoke actually to Henry Kissinger before he died about this. What did he have to say about it?
Yeah, so he wrote a book with Eric Schmidt of Google where he was talking about the kind of geopolitical implications of AI. And he made the point that AI was like any other kind of weapon of mass destruction, as it were, because it contained three different dimensions. First, it's a dual-use technology. Second, it has mass destructive powers. And third, it's easy to apply. So if you think about nuclear technology, it covers two of those, but it's not actually very easy to develop or apply. You've pretty much got to be a state to do that. But for a lot of AI weapons, particularly in cyber or messing with other countries' nuclear codes or whatever, you can imagine hackers being able to do that. And so therefore, it is that the bar to application of this or use of this technology is a lot lower. And that's what he was really concerned about. How on earth do you attempt to regulate this and prevent the kind of race dynamics from accelerating when it is so hard to see what people are doing in this area, let alone verify or prove what people are doing and what their capabilities are. So it's the incredible kind of invisible use of AI technology that could be so threatening. And it is quite hard to see how you prevent those dynamics if they're America and China can agree these are areas which you should not tamper with. And frankly, we have no idea where those discussions are really going at the moment and to what extent they are advancing.
I mean, it is a big contrast, isn't it, with the Manhattan Project, which was done in complete secrecy, where all the people who knew about it were locked up in the desert and told, come out when you've cracked this problem, but don't spread the information. This is completely anarchic compared to that. Tai-Wei, I mean, when John talks about the American concerns about the destructive potential of AI. I mean, you said earlier that the Chinese seem to be basically more optimistic in their approach to it. But do those concerns exist? I mean, both in the military aspects or bioweapons and all of that, but also the idea of a superintelligence that might at some point develop its own motivations, turn against humanity. Is there a similar debate going on in China?
HAI, Stanford's Human-Centered AI Institution, published a study on the optimism level about AI in different countries around the world. And China is the highest. And the optimism in public around AI is almost double compared to people in the US or UK. I think that is a powerful fuel for adopting the technology and pushing it further. But I also think like the guardrails and the precaution that a lot of like voices in the West are also very crucial. This time around, I think China is taking a lot of precaution and try to lead a lot of effort in both, as we see in WAIC, which is a big AI conference that happened in Shanghai a few months ago. And Chinese President Xi Jinping also just visited South Korea, and he proposed to establish a global organization to set AI standard. He basically pitched a Shanghai-based group that would set rules for international governance, and this global standard and agreement that will potentially set rules and establish a common ground for different countries to build on this technology and keep like bad players from using it in harmful ways is not just crucial, but also an important opportunity. So whichever country that led the effort will have a lot of negotiation power. And I think China, with this very proactive effort on establishing the global standard, there is an opportunity for China to marry that to the open source culture, like John mentioned, and start this global conversation.
Yes, I can't imagine, John, that given all the paranoia about AI leadership in America, that they're going to accept a regulatory body based in Shanghai, but maybe I'm too pessimistic. But just to finish, I mean, we talked about the military applications and the concerns about AGI, but what about the social applications? Because Tai-Wei, I was just in China and I was struck by, well, lots of things, but two in particular. One was this kind of technological optimism that you talked about, but also this undercurrent of concern about youth unemployment and about graduates not getting jobs at the levels that they expected. And certainly in America, you're now getting concerns that you're getting layoffs because of AI. Do you have a sense, let's start with you, Tai-Wei, looking at both countries, America and China, that they've yet thought through the employment impact of AI?
That is so tough. China is going through a historical youth unemployment period now and a historical slowdown of its high-speed economy. And it's tough. Like, the impact is very real. I've seen reports of, like, entry-level jobs specifically being heavily replaced by AI. And it's harder than ever for young people to start getting experience in an industry. But I think China's response to that, as like we've seen in a lot of college curriculums and training workshops, is for students to equip themselves with AI literacy. So knowing how to use AI more effectively and pair like human input with your knowledge and know-how with the system becomes a very important selling point. And a lot of the job posts these days are explicitly asking for candidates who are proficient in using these AI systems. So I think there are two sides of the coin. I think AI is perceived as this almost savior and the only hopeful element in the economy these days that's getting a lot of government support and genuinely get people excited. And also on the labor market side, creating a lot of new opportunities while making some previously entry-level and more repetitive jobs obsolete.
Interesting, yeah, because that certainly contrasts what you're saying, how Chinese universities are responding. I was talking to people at British universities who were saying, well, we're going to have to go back to pen and paper exams so that their people can't use AI rather than incorporating it. John, I mean, what's your view of the social impact? I must say that I now read the business pages with a degree of alarm, because it does seem to me there is a trend now with big layoffs in companies, Amazon, Target, which seem to me they must reflect the deployment of AI.
For sure, that's a big factor, I think. And I think it's very telling that the Magnificent Seven tech companies like Alphabet, the owner of Google, Tesla, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, who are applying AI the most, are some of the most active companies in shedding labor at the moment. And in particular, the hiring of new software engineers has slowed down very dramatically in these companies. And I think that's obviously a kind of leading edge of what the technology can do. And so I think you will see a kind of seepage of AI as it's applied to other sectors will reduce the need for a lot of jobs. However, I think what we cannot foresee at the moment is the investments and the jobs that will be created in some of these complementary areas that I was talking about before. I mean, it's always very difficult when a new technology comes in to predict what the industries of the future that will be enabled by that technology are going to be. And so I think it's quite possible that we will see new job creation in wholly new areas that are very difficult to predict at the moment. And so I think there will be a counterbalancing over time between where jobs are shed as a result of AI and where jobs are created as a result of AI.
And last question, we're sitting here in Britain, and the British government has, I think, made quite a strong effort to be at the forefront of thinking about AI and so on. And also, as with the Chinese, as we were just hearing, and the Americans, very seized of what this means for the development of the economy. Do you think, as people in the industry here look for lessons, that they are as aware of what's happening in China as they are of what's happening in the United States? Or do we still think this is an American story and really miss the China aspect?
Well, certainly in London, I think we're totally obsessed by what is going on in America and rather ignoring what is going on in China. And I think in some ways, Europe and Britain have a lot more to learn from China than we do from the US. I think Britain is trying desperately to boost its AI infrastructure, and you'll have a number of kind of American companies that are coming here and offering to build big data centers. And we have some local companies like Nscale that are trying to do the same. It's very difficult to build a massive AI data center fast because planning restrictions in this country are incredibly onerous and energy costs are extraordinarily high. So we're going to be hampered, I think, in that kind of infrastructure layer and how we're going to use the technology. But where Britain and I think other European countries do have a lot to learn from China is at the application layer, in the same way that China is, I think, forging ahead in applying AI in this interface between software and hardware. There's a real opportunity for Europe to do that as well. And in particular, you think of countries like Germany, which have this extraordinary manufacturing heritage. And you are seeing companies that are developing now who are trying to apply AI in all of these kind of hardware domains. And I think that's where Europe can compete. I think in terms of kind of material discovery or drug discovery of AI systems to kind of manufacturing production, there are some really interesting startups that are emerging in Europe. And I think that's where Europe does have a chance to compete.
That was the FT's innovation editor, John Thornhill, speaking to me in London and ending this edition of the Rachman Review. And we were joined on the line from the US by Tsai-Wei Chen of the MIT Technology Review.